here in New York City this weekend, all through tonight and tomorrow morning at 10:30, as well as through the afternoon and evening and Sunday for the opening, the theatrical release of Steal the Story, Please, about the 30 years of Democracy Now. I'll be there with the directors of the film, T. Lesson and Carl Diehl, and many others. You can check it all out at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for jobs. I'm Amy Goodman.
Support for KFII comes from First Avenue, presenting Snow the Product, Sunday, April 19th. From the underground to the main room stage, the bilingual singer-rapper comes ready to leave her mark with her rapid-fire flows and strong lyrics, seamlessly weaving hip-hop and Latin music. More information about Snow the Product can be found at first-avenue.com.
And this is Community Radio. It's KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org. Sure, take a deep breath, have another hit of fresh air.
Miniculture is back for season 10. On this season, we're going back in time.
The first thing the Irish discovered when they came to the United States was that the streets were not paved with gold. Second thing they discovered was that the streets were not paved at all. And the third was that they were expected to pave them.
And so Paramount said to the theaters, here, take this other movie, Harold and Maude. It stars Academy Award winner Ruth Gordon. And you'll like this as much as The Godfather.
We're digging up mysteries.
It's weird because I'm thinking, how many times did I literally drive the boat over this, not knowing that he's down there, the car's down there?
We're exploring transitions.
When it was announced publicly that the cafe was going to be up for sale, people freaked out.
And we're singing our hearts out. For the vast majority of the people in the choir, the last time they were sharing space and singing with others, they probably had pimples and braces and felt awkward in their skin. Minnesota's Art, History, and Culture podcast is celebrating 10 years of storytelling with a brand new season. Miniculture Season 10, coming April 9th.
How about that? It's here, out right now. Just dropped last week. Check your podcast feed or subscribe today. Good afternoon and welcome to Miniculture Presents, found here on your radio dial every Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock. My name is Michael Whetstone. You are going to be glad you've joined me here today because on Miniculture Presents, we are thrilled to unveil the latest release of the Miniculture podcast, now embarking on their 10th season. In today's episode, we are going to go inside the walls of the Stillwater Prison and learn about their prison newspaper. If you are just making a short trip in your car or can't stick around the radio for the whole show, you can check it off the broadcast airwaves when you subscribe to the award-winning Miniculture podcast. Wherever you'd like to download and listen to such things, it is all over the place in all those spots that you might expect. But you can also find it and everything else Miniculture puts out on their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture, or at kfei.org under the Miniculture tab. I urge you to go back and give a listen to all their seasons. They are all out there waiting for you to enjoy. Plus, new episodes of Season 10 will be continually dropping over the next month or so. And perhaps we'll try to get them on the air here too. But for now, KFEI proudly presents the Miniculture Podcast, Season 10, Episode 1. And we are going to kick off this new season again with a story by Michelle Brook. You may remember her contribution from last season about the Underground Railroad. If not, go back, check it out. Season 9, Episode 1, Seeking Freedom in Minnesota. Today's story, like I said, we are going inside the wall, behind the bars, and learn the history of the prison mirror. Here is the Miniculture Podcast, Season 10, Episode 1, The Silent City's Newspaper.
Welcome to the Mini Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Erica Janik. Stillwater Prison started publishing its own newspaper in 1887. It's written, edited, and even funded by incarcerated people. It's called the Prison Mirror. When it started, it was one of the country's first prison papers. And today, it's one of the last. Throughout its history, the Prison Mirror has given incarcerated writers a voice and national recognition, even book deals, journalism jobs, and pardons. But that coverage has also landed them in trouble with the warden's office and put their personal safety at risk. As Stillwater Prison prepares to close, Michelle Brooke talked to people inside and outside prison to learn about what it's like covering the news behind bars. The first prison in Minnesota Territory opened right on Stillwater's Main Street in 1853. The guards enforced a very long list of rules.
No talking. The prison had a nickname. They called it the Silent City because the inmates were not allowed to speak to one another.
Heidi Hines directs a museum in the old house where the prison wardens lived. She explained that even in the mess hall, talking was forbidden. If you wanted bread, you'd hold up your right hand. More water, hold up your cup.
They weren't even allowed to make eye contact. Your eyes were to be downcast. Everybody had to march lockstep. They absolutely were beaten. Every guard is given a cane with a metal tip on it that they did use to beat inmates.
The Stillwater Prison relocated in 1914 to its present location, a couple miles south in Bayport. The warden's house where Heidi works is the last surviving building on the original site. People say it's haunted.
I'll leave things a certain way at night and go home and nobody's here. I come back in the morning and it's different. I've had weird audio things, and you should go back and listen to this and see if you can hear anything in the background. I've heard audio of me giving a tour where there's a ghost that finishes my sentences. If I pause, you can hear a voice.
I didn't hear anything.
And it's kind of hard to determine who is the ghost of the warden's house, because there's a lot of candidates. Innumerable true tales of terror and tragedy happened within the walls.
For example, the punishment for talking in 1888 was solitary confinement for 6 days.
They would be put in the hole or the dungeon, which was a dark cell with no light. They were chained up typically during the day. They would handcuff their hands about a foot above their head all day long. And then they would lay on a plank on the stone floor was how they would sleep. So pretty severe punishments. And some men were put in the hole repeatedly.
Prisons across the country enforced the silent system that was first developed in New York. Stillwater evolved over the years to allow talking at mealtimes and holidays, but the rule of silence continued until 1951. For those who could read all they wanted. And in 1887, Louis P. Schoonmaker convinced the warden to let him go cell to cell and raise money to start a newspaper. Louis was in and out of prison for forgery, and he previously started a prison paper in Wisconsin that didn't last a year. He collected $200 from 15 incarcerated people to start the Stillwater Prison Mirror. They announced it was the only printed sheet in existence, organized, published, edited, and sent forth to the world by prisoners. The Minnesota Correctional Facility Stillwater is scheduled to close in 2029. Department of Corrections staff are talking about moving the paper to another prison to keep its legacy alive. Because the Mirror is the nation's oldest prison newspaper that's still operating today.
This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Hello, my name is Ronald Greer. I was associate editor and sports editor for the Prison Mirror, the longest continuously printed prison newspaper in America. I was an editor there from 2017 to 2020. But how much information would you like? I can ramble.
Ronald Greer is the pre-press technician at Moose Lake, where he's incarcerated for homicide. I asked him if he'd ever heard of Stillwater's rule about enforced silence.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So one of the things that me and Jeff Young would do, we would always read back through all the old prison mirrors, like from the beginning, right? And that was one of the things that me and him recall seeing, like, man, they couldn't talk. Like, it was, like, almost illegal to talk. And I was like, well, that's what you call a hard time.
The prisoners used sign language and whispered whenever a guard's back was turned. But the silence system was oppressive. Prison mirror writers said they felt like beasts in the field, their brains becoming so small they couldn't give a sensible reply when spoken to. Locked in a cell for hours each night, one man said he needed to read if he wished to keep sane.
I like to see that even they, 140 years ago, found a way to heal something in themselves by, you know, by creating a paper and giving back to a community. And that's really what prison journalism is, or definitely the prison mirror.
The first two editions had a motto that stated, "God helps those who help themselves." That got a big laugh out of readers who said prisoners do help themselves to steal. So the next paper had a new motto, "It is never too late to mend." That's still on the cover of every edition.
The motto that came later is "never too late to mend." So obviously it's a prison newspaper. A crime was committed, the judicial process was carried out, and then a person like myself and all the other editors land themselves in prison, but then they find this outlet that somehow can help restore something in you, but also restores something in everybody else.
Three brothers invested a quarter of the money to start the paper. The Younger brothers.
Cole and Jim and Bob Younger rode with the Jesse James gang, and they were notorious bank robbers and train robbers for about 10 years after the Civil War.
The James and Younger families grew up in Missouri, where they supported the Confederate side of the Civil War. The older brothers joined a group of guerrilla soldiers notorious for committing mass murder in the Union town of Lawrence, Kansas. After the war, they learned that a Union general they despised had a lot of money invested at a bank in Northfield.
And in 1876, they came to Northfield, Minnesota to try to rob the bank, and it didn't go well. Several townspeople were killed and some of the robbers, too.
Faced with a possible sentence to hang, the Youngers pleaded guilty. They were sentenced to life in prison.
It was truly a media circus when they came here to Stillwater, and it was a big deal.
This song, Cole Younger, written by the famous outlaw Cole Younger, on his the wall of his cell at Stillwater Prison, Minnesota. "I am a noted vengeance man, Cole Younger is my name."
In 1876, these were celebrities.
"My friends to shame for the robbing of the Northfield Bank, and the same I can never deny. For that deed, I'm a poor prisoner in the Stillwater jail I lie."
They were well-loved by the prisoners, I think, and by the wardens alike. And so I imagine it was a certain amount of clout to be amongst this select group of men who were starting this newspaper.
This was not the country's first prison paper, but it captured attention because it was a grassroots effort by prisoners and not the warden. It wasn't quite as proper and sanitized as other prison papers funded by states on the East Coast. The prison mirror did have a few critics. The Minneapolis Tribune wrote that men in the penitentiary should not have the liberty to print scandalous criminal news. Nevertheless, within a year, annual $1 subscriptions came from nearly every state in the Union. The prison mirror covered all expenses. The incarcerated investors got their money back with interest, and they even had $150 in profits to give to the prison library.
Newspapers in this part of the country were kind of just getting their footing, and it was a big, big deal to have a newspaper in your community.
A typical four-page edition on May 13, 1909 featured short stories and reader letters. There were jokes, baseball scores. Page 3 contained local news. Old Butch is laid up with a hurt shoulder. Canaries were born in the prison last week. The librarian has a Saturday Evening Post. Anyone interested in a copy can notify cell 531 through the guard. One editor in 1926 encouraged any prisoner to submit a piece, stating, "Yes, we have the silent system here, but that doesn't prevent your talking with pens and pencils." They couldn't write about politics, but they exchanged papers with other newsrooms, and they could share national news.
They love a good story about a wrongfully convicted man being freed. Those always make the newspaper. And they also, in this day and age of, like, robber barons, people making all kinds of ridiculous money and breaking laws, this is not lost on them in here. They like to kind of point out, you know, we're in here for stealing $8. And meanwhile, these bigwig bankers and politicians are on the hook for thousands and millions of dollars and nothing happens to them.
The newspaper included advertising.
And that's in Stillwater, too. Oh, boy, we've got tailors.
Heidi pages through some of the ads.
Con Hames Clothing House, which is here in Stillwater. They have the largest stock and the latest styles. Stoves, tinware, dry goods, millinery house. That's a hat maker. Hardware, boots and shoes, groceries. They're advertising just about everything in this paper.
One ad in 1894 announced, "Prisoners break out with laughter when they read Watson's Illuminator." But that's not just a joke. People escaped all the time.
Literally breaking through the walls. Like, you could rip a bar off of something and use it to dig a hole in the wall. People would just, like, lift the gate off its hinges. I've heard of people digging underground, climbing over the wall, like having somebody come and throw a rope over the wall and climbing up over. There were many, many escapes in the early years.
Frank Landers was described as a smooth talker, serving 24 years for forgery. He gave $20 to start the prison mirror. The guards gave him an extra hour in the halls each night to educate younger prisoners and gather material for the paper. He was really planning the best way out. He convinced the prison barber, Oscar Carlin, to help him, even though Oscar only had a few months remaining in his sentence. On October 12, 1887, while others returned to their cells for the night, Frank and Oscar bent a bar in the barbershop window to get into the yard and then tore off a board from the exterior fence. Detectives recognized Frank in Chicago, but they thought the $100 reward for capture was too small. They let him go. Oscar was not so lucky. Tracing his letters, police found Oscar working at a barbershop in Chicago and returned him to prison. Women were also incarcerated at Stillwater until 1920. Azilda Beaudry wrote in the paper, "Here hangs before me in a little frame the picture of two dear children. They are mine, but where are they?" One after another, three of Azilda's children died while she was incarcerated. She wrote, "Is it possible for one to commit a crime so great that no amount of suffering will pay the penalty?" One Mirror columnist, John Carter, lost a farming job in Canada in 1904. He'd been trying to make his way to Minneapolis, and he stole a ride on a boxcar. The train crew discovered him and threw him off the train in Kitson County. He hadn't eaten anything for 36 hours. He broke into the station's cash drawer, and he was caught. For the crime of stealing $24, he was sentenced to 10 years in Stillwater. Carter learned to play the clarinet in the prison band. He taught other prisoners to read in night school. One 45-year-old man told him the reading lessons made it worth being incarcerated.
But it was his poetry that ultimately kind of got him out of here.
Carter wrote poetry in the Mirror that was republished in Harper's and Century magazine. He received job offers and calls for his pardon. He was released in 1910 on grounds that his sentence was excessive. When he got out, Carter wrote that Stillwater Prison was inconceivably foul, but he had only good things to say about the prison mirror. He said, "Few prisoners can write well, but they know things worth writing."
People have always been fascinated by prison. I think now there's a surge of people being interested in true crime. And really, that's not new. I think that people 100 years ago, 150 years ago, really were clamoring to know more about life in prison. And they still are. You know, it's like the kind of secret that nobody wants to talk about. Every place needs a prison, but it's kind of a hidden world. So I'm really thankful for the prison mirror and other things that give you an insight.
Department of Corrections, Moose Lake Correctional Facility. To accept this free call, press 0.
My name is Donovan Diego. I'm currently work as a tutor in the education department and received a bachelor's degree while I was in Stillwater.
Donovan participated in a research group while incarcerated for homicide. He researched the history of the prison mirror.
Along with this research cluster, I was going through a book. I believe the book is in the Minnesota Historical Society, but it had actual photos of like the living block units. And as I'm looking at the photo, I was able to identify the unit that we were looking at. And I'm like, I know that unit. I've spent years in that unit. It looks the exact same. That was a little eerie to me.
Donovan was struck by what he did not see in the prison mirror. For example, he knew there were Minnesota prison rebellions in the 70s, but he couldn't find anything about that in the paper.
Kind of made me think about like what the majority of the population felt when they were seeing those articles come out. And I was wondering if they kind of felt, you know, maybe a little cheated or betrayed by a lot of the writers by thinking that you guys aren't really writing about or capturing what's really going on in here.
There was a time when incarcerated people jokingly referred to the prison mirror as the good news newspaper. Responding to this criticism in 1973, editor Norman Mastrian wrote that they were censored. Sometimes they had to trash articles that took a lot of work. He said they had little to gain from writing lurid details of disturbances inside prison. Plus, they wanted to put their best foot forward for everyone reading outside the walls. He said they must tread a thin line between being censored and being seen as pro-administration.
Our former editor had some issues, and he ran into a problem in the dining hall at Stillwater. And he got assaulted there for something. He made somebody angry. And so he decided it was kind of a forced retirement.
This is Robert Taliaferro.
Prisons aren't a place where you want to make people angry sometimes, you know, especially back then. You know, it was a safe place to a point, but Stillwater used to have a reputation.
Robert was next in line for the editor job. He always kept the maximum allowable 20 books in his cell, and he got every book he could find on journalism. He came up with his own approach to coverage.
First of all, we're not going to talk about why a person was in prison, number one. Number two, we're not going to advocate for anybody's cases. We're not lawyers. What we will do, however, if a guy is sitting up there and he creates a bonsai tree and he gets a blue ribbon for it, we're going to put his face in there. Here's something that you could show to your mama or your kids. We are not the monsters that the mainstream media wants you to believe. We're just human beings who made mistakes. It was my job and my writers to tell a story that here's what they're doing while they're incarcerated.
Robert's paper covered incarcerated cooks who made hot pot burritos on Super Bowl Sunday. In the style of USA Today, he ran prisoner portraits alongside their takes on national issues. He closely monitored the finances at the prison canteen, which was taking in millions from prisoners each year. One of his writers investigated a Department of Corrections contractor. They won a lot of prison newspaper awards. Robert expected excellence and no spelling mistakes.
My punishment was, if you have a misspelled word, after all of this stuff, we have dictionaries, you owe the office a six-pack. No beers, but all a six-pack of soda.
Robert's office had a fireproof safe containing the entire archive of the prison mirror. He'd look through it from time to time.
I was able to see over 100 years of history seen through the eyes of incarcerated men and women. What's the take of incarcerated folks when it came to World War I or World War II or the Korean War or the beginning of Vietnam?
In 1918, during World War I, prisoners collectively earned $75,000 in wages and donated $62,000 to the war effort. During World War II, they manufactured rope for the Army and Navy and donated blood to the Red Cross. In 1974, a prisoner joked that it was great to have Nixon, a crook, as president. He said, "It's about time one of us got the recognition he deserves." Robert oversaw the paper during the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
You know, at that particular time, especially in the early 80s, no one knew how HIV or AIDS was transmitted. You know, there was rumors about mosquitoes. There was all of these different things. We had one individual for sure that did have HIV and AIDS inside the facility. And so, you know, it was like, what do we do? I mean, even what they did at that period of time for that young man's safety, they segregated him. And unfortunately, he died. His family kind of disowned him and all that, and he died alone. And that was not a good time either. So,
Robert spent 38 years in prison. He was released in 2022. He remembers feeling uncertain if he would ever see the outside.
Maybe I will die in prison. I don't know. But I'm not going to die yet. I'm not going to die mentally in prison. And, you know, some people do that. You see, when there are guys where I would look in their eyes and I'd see they're just blank. There was no life there. They were done. That was it. That was it for them. They didn't care. They quit. And I said, well, I'm not going to quit.
When I first started there, I think the very first day, I walk around and I'm looking at this guy's desk area.
This is Martin Hawthorne, who started working at Stillwater Prison in 2005.
He's creating a board game, and it's How to Survive in Prison. And it was like the game of life, right? And the very first square, I'll never forget this, it looked at, you, if you roll a one or spin a one, like in the game of life, first block says, oh, new to prison, got to fight for your life, go to SAG, go back to start.
Martin provided vocational training in computers for 20 years. He thought it was important to educate people who'd been inside for decades, while technology evolved quickly outside.
When my buddies now used to talk to me about that stuff, I'd say, you know, it's like 94% of all convicted felons get released. So do you want to have, and this goes back to the warden in 1887, do you want to have somebody just sat for 8-9 years in a little 6x8 cage, did nothing but get more mad, or do you want to get them to figure out what they got going on in their life and give them the tools, put them in their little society toolbox to function in society? I'd rather do that.
Martin could teach Photoshop and design, and he ended up supervising the mirror for more than a decade until the fall of 2025. Prison mirror editors make $1.50 per hour. That's a relatively high wage for the prison system, where pay starts at 25 cents an hour. Whenever a newspaper job opened up, Martin vetted 3 or 4 applicants. He checked math and reading levels and gave them a sample writing assignment. And he checked their prison discipline record to be assured they could stay in the office for several months of training.
Everybody's got to know how to do everything. We can't just have the sports guy know how to do something and all of a sudden he gets beaten up or something, you know, he's gone. And they could be transferred at any time, too.
Editors do the job without access to the internet, but they can ask their supervisor or their family to look something up online.
A lot of the stuff would be us reaching out to family and friends over the phone and then us taking longhand notes, dying notes, coming up, typing it in. And we have the tool to put the paper together, second to none.
Yeah.
But the information available to us, almost non-existent. You know what I'm saying? It's like, there's something wrong with this picture. Yeah.
This is Carlos Sessions, a current Prison Mirror associate editor who's incarcerated for homicide. He said editors can access the Star Tribune. They can mail letters through the Postal Service. They can make phone calls that disconnect after 15 minutes. They have an email system called JPay, although contact must be initiated by someone on the outside, and it costs 40 cents to send a message. And they can interview people inside the prison. Carlos said he's noticed in the past that being part of the paper can open doors for guys.
I mean, I remember seeing them on the yard damn near. Whenever they had the yard open, they were out there. Someone from the paper was out there. It's the same with the gymnasium rec. Wherever, you know, you can see guys going, you don't live over here, you live in another unit. So they did have access.
The newspaper covers all kinds of prison programming, like graduations, treatment programs, cultural meals and sports, all happening inside the prison.
I covered all sport events, ping pong, chess,
handball, soccer, football, softball, basketball, 3-on-3, 5-on-5, volleyball.
This is Ronald Greer, the pre-press technician you heard at the beginning of the story. One of his favorite articles covered a softball team from the prison's mental health program.
Usually, they participate in sports. They go defeated throughout the entire season. They never win a game. Just watching the game, I sat there and I was like, I don't believe this. Like, oh, they have the lead. I was like, oh, they still have the lead. And then they won. But it was like they did not know they won, because why I really like this article is because they didn't go out to say, I won, we did this. They went out to just play. And that's why it was so important, because the outcome didn't matter, right?
You have 1 minute remaining.
That was great. And that was one of my more joyous articles to write.
I asked Ronald how he thought about criminal history during his interviews.
I try not to ever know why they're in prison. I only care about the person sitting in front of me. Who are you right now at this very exact moment? Obviously, you're in prison. Something happened, right? I don't want to know the heinousness of the crime, or if you were, or if the judicial system was correct in passing out punishment or justice, I have to say. I only care about the person in front of me right now and how are you presenting yourself. That's also one of the reasons I only wanted to be the sports editor at first. I was like, I don't have to dig into anybody's life. No, I can just see what you're doing on the field and that's it. I get this, you know, this very superficial image of a person, of most your sportsmanship and your physical attributes and your skill inside of sport. But, you know, the more you write, the more you want to write different stories. So I began writing other stories just about the actual individuals instead of what they did in the game.
You are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI. My name is Mike Whetstone, and we are taking a momentary break from today's brand spanking new Hot Off the Press episode 1 of season 10 of the Mini Culture podcast. And we're going to return to our story, The Silent Cities Newspaper by Michelle Brook, right after these messages.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting An Evening with a Lash, Thursday, April 16th. Masters of traditional tuba instruments, as well as the ancient art of throat singing, Alash returned to the Cedar stage. Alash take traditional Tuvan music in a new direction by subtly blending in elements of Western music, creating their own unique style while still staying true to their musical heritage. More information about An Evening with Alash at the Cedar is available at thecedar.org.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Minnesota Lottery. Funds from the lottery support environmental projects, retailers, state programs, and more. It all adds up to a better Minnesota. More information is online at mnlottery.com/playingourpart.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Hook and Ladder Theater and Lounge, presenting Beth Bambara and Mother Banjo live on the Zen Arcade stage Sunday, April 19th. Beth Bambara's music lives at the intersection of 70s folk soul and 90s indie rock. She's touring with her latest release, It All Goes Up, while Mother Banjo opens the show with her signature blend of indie, folk, and bluegrass songs. More information about Beth Bambara and Mother Banjo at the Hook and Ladder Theater is available at thehookmpls.com.
KFAI invites you to join us for the 23rd annual Balkanicus concert.
Artsy and avant-garde, emotional, upbeat, and irregular. And at the end of it, meet performers and fellow music lovers over a tasty Mediterranean reception, featuring music from Albanian, Bulgarian, and Serbian composers. All the pieces are American premieres, and as always, Balkanicus will premiere a piece new to the world. Saturday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at Alton Recital Hall on the U of M West Bank campus. Free and open to the public. All are welcome. If you have never experienced this music before, here's your opportunity to join us.
Visit kfai.org/Balkan for more details.
Support comes from the YWCA Minneapolis, providing early childhood education for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers in the Twin Cities. For more than 50 years, the YWCA Minneapolis has helped children build confidence, make friends, and develop a love of learning in classrooms where every child feels welcome, supported, and valued. Learn more at ywcamplus.org.
Don't waste it. Recycle it.
Every pop can, every cardboard box, every hot sauce bottle counts.
That random junk mail, tomorrow's cereal box.
That glass bottle, next month's pickle jar.
That pop can, back on the shelf in just 60 days.
Don't waste it. Recycle it.
Because in Minneapolis, what goes around comes right back around.
What else should you recycle?
Search Minneapolis Recycling to learn more.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Jews and Blues Inside Out.
What care I who makes the laws of a nation? Let those who will take care of its rights and wrongs. What care I who cares for the world's affairs? As long as I can sing its popular songs. Let me sing a funny song with crazy words that roll along. And if my song can start you laughing, I'm happy, so happy. Let me sing a sad refrain of broken hearts that loved in vain. And if my song can start you crying, I'm happy.
Tin Pan Alley was the place where Jewish songwriters plighted their troth to the New World. In words and music, they declared their love and loyalty to America. Tin Pan Alley was also a real place. Initially located in an alley off 14th Street near the Lower East Side in New York, it was a place where the music publishers had their offices and tiny studios where songwriters banged out new tunes on metallic old upright pianos. Passers-by thought it sounded like tin pans being beaten. Hence the name. New songs were a big business, not for recording, but to be sold as sheet music and piano rolls to be played in the parlors of America. Alexander's Ragtime Band showed just how big the market for Berlin synthesis of blues and ragtime was. This kind of song, whether written by Hubie Blake and Noble Sissel or George and Ira Gershwin, quickly came to define for the rest of the world what American music sounded like. The cultural amalgamation of African-American and Jewish musical sensibilities took hold so quickly and so successfully that by 1924, songwriter George Gershwin was self-consciously synthesizing a distinctly American form of classical music. Physically changed location, following New York's Pleasure Center up Broadway, eventually landing in the Brill Building just north of Times Square. The alley's largely Jewish songwriters continued writing the tunes, which became standards of the repertoire and would provide the melodic and harmonic backbone of jazz as that improvisatory music evolved into bebop. The Brill Building, where many Tin Pan Alley songwriters worked, would eventually become the home of rock and roll songwriters. The musical styles might change, but the social dynamic remained the same as it was when Irving Berlin discovered ragtime. And African-American music, say rhythm and blues, would be reinterpreted, reinvented for white America by Jewish songwriters and turned into rock and roll. And now, our story enters the painful world of race relations.
We don't really have a vernacular for discussing the social order the way that it's actually shaken out.
Clarinetist Don Byron.
That's why these discussions are awkward.
The chief question in this story is, was this creative process simply exploitative of black musicians, or was it as fair an exchange as possible of musical ideas in a world that was segregated legally and by social custom? The truth of the situation is, there's not one truth. If you grew up after the great civil rights era, the odds are you see it as a story of exploitation. You wonder why Gershwin's concert at the Aeolian Hall is common knowledge, while African-American conductor James Reese Europe's 1912 ragtime concert at Carnegie Hall, the first time black music was played there, isn't. You retell the tale of white bandleader Paul Whiteman sending musical copyists to the Cotton Club to take down, note by note, Duke Ellington's arrangements when the Duke refused to sell them to Whiteman. But if you grew up in the days when black musicians weren't allowed to play with white musicians, you might see things differently. Listen to bassist Milt Hinton and pianist Billy Taylor reminiscing on a Library of Congress recording about the Cantor's son, Harold Arlen, and his work at the Cotton Club.
Harold Arlen and many of those people that wrote for the Cotton Club, they really assimilated the jazz spirit. I mean, they knew the kind of voices they were writing for, the kind of dancers they were scoring for.
Well, they had a race relationship there.
Right.
And we don't give credence to it now. But I knew Harold Arlen. I knew him very well. In fact, I made a record with him singing. He was a marvelous singer.
And pianist.
Yeah, pianist. Yeah. And man, you want to hear Stormy Weather, you should hear him sing Stormy
Weather.
Really? He really sang.
Arlen, he lived through so much of that history.
And, absolutely.
You know, he did. Off the top of the head, say, oh, yeah, when I was at the Cotton Club, so-and-so was happening,
that's
and so-and-so
right.
was there and all that. And, I mean, it's just history, you know.
That's right. That's the reason I happen to know about him being with Fletcher Henderson. He was Fletcher Henderson's rehearsal pianist. So he was in Harlem and involved in it.
And harmonically, he was so sophisticated. He incorporated all of that kind of thing that came out of the black vocal, the way people talked and the way they sang. And you can hear that in his melodies, you
that's
know.
That's right. The same thing with Gershwin.
Mm-hmm.
What is true is that throughout the period where the basics of American song were being created, the main social interface between African Americans and white Americans was the interaction between blacks and Jews. The only place where blacks and whites could work together was in the worlds of music and the world of left-wing politics. In both, most of the whites were Jews. Mark Nason, professor of African American studies at Fordham University, points to two reasons for this.
First of all, it wasn't clear they were white. Their status was somewhere in between African Americans and the sort of Anglo-Saxon majority. Jews came to the United States with these radical and socialist traditions that were universalistic, and in some instances they found themselves immersing themselves in African American cultural forms and also beginning to feel that this issue of race in America had a powerful connection to them.
Of course, not all Jews were involved in progressive politics, but the majority of whites in cities attracted to progressive politics were Jews, and racial justice was a core issue of the left. According to historian Nason, author of Communists in Harlem During the Depression, the far left worked hard to break down the social taboos about racial mixing.
The Communist Party organized interracial dances. because they wanted to directly take on the taboo against social equality. So you'd have an interracial dance in Harlem, and whites in the movement would dance with African Americans, and sometimes out of that, friendships and intimate relationships would occur. And those were encouraged by the Communist Party. Interracial intimacy was seen as a direct challenge to the racial prejudices and the divisions in the working class. So you began to have a certain amount of, not under the cover of night, interracial sexuality, which has always existed in America, but open interracial dating and interracial marriage. We're not talking about tens of thousands of people, but we are talking about hundreds and possibly thousands of people breaking these taboos in a supportive culture.
These interracial dances brought together the top musical talent of the era.
You have an interracial dance, Duke Ellington is going to be invited to play there, or Teddy Wilson. I mean, the top African-American musicians of Harlem were drawn into this, and they were also drawn into benefits for the Scottsboro Boys, where you might also have the Marx Brothers come in.
Pressure to integrate the music business came from the left as well. Until well into the 1930s, bands, on stage at least, were segregated. Then Benny Goodman, at the suggestion of his producer John Hammond, decided to change things, playing with pianist Teddy Wilson, heard here reminiscing with Milt Hinton in a Library of Congress recording.
We had a tremendous big audience watching this new thing of racial mixing on an equal basis. Because before that, the racial mixing would be like Ted Lewis doing Me and My Shadow. Right. He'd prance around the stage singing Me and My Shadow, and the little Negro boy would be following him and imitating every motion and be the shadow.
Right.
That category of appearing. But a lot of cities and states, it was illegal for the two races to be on the stage at the same time.
So no matter how popular the sounds being created in this black-Jewish fusion of music and politics were, they weren't powerful enough to overcome the prejudices in much of the country. When Artie Shaw took Billie Holiday on a tour of the South, the bandleader recalled in a Library of Congress interview, it was a very quick trip.
We finished the tune, I think it was Traveling. She finished it, a lot of applause, and she went back to sit down in her chair. You know, those days the girl singer sat in the crook of the piano. And some redneck standing in front of the band hollered, have the nigger went sing another song. So I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, I gave a downbeat or two beats. We went into back bay shuffle or something immediately. He kept yelling, Billy sitting there, and I could see something's out. All of a sudden, she leans forward, and I could see these words, motherfucker, son of a bitch, bastard, coming out of her. And the guy saw what she was doing. She was really hissing at him. Well, all of a sudden, little knots forming. I mean, you could see groups of people. I got nervous. I thought, you know, this has got the makings of a riot, yeah. A lynch. So I went, and my bus driver and my truck driver and a couple of cops that I had posted came in, closed in on her, took her out, put her in the bus, and drove away. That was the end of Billy's Southern tour.
Despite incidents like that, the movement towards integration under the cover of music continued, reaching its apex in 1938, when Barney Josephson opened Cafe Society in New York. It was the only nightclub outside of Harlem where blacks and whites could mix. There, Billie Holiday, night after night, sang the signature song of the era.
And now I'd like to sing a tune. It was written especially for me. It's titled Strange Fruit. I do hope you like it.
Strange Fruit was written by Abel Mirapol, a Jewish high school teacher from the Bronx.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
After the Second World War, the musical interchange between blacks and Jews continued to redefine American popular music. There was music for pleasure, rock and roll. There was music for politics, the apotheosis being Bob Dylan and his blues-tinged songs, and a vocal style that was a perfect tenor balance of the krext and the growl. But since the mid-60s, the music world, as well as the world of progressive politics, has fragmented. A reassessment of race relations in the music business between blacks and Jews is constant, and some of the discourse has been painful. The hurt on both sides is profound, and many of the people still alive who made this history simply won't discuss it. It's down to younger musicians like Hank Osnetsky and Don Byron, who used to play together in a klezmer band, to offer a comment on the meaning of race in the creation of our nation's popular music. Byron says that racial attitudes still limit the majority population's ability to accept blues-derived music from the people who are its source.
People kind of monitor how much color they have in their life. Essentially, people want the product of black musicians, but they don't want it in a real concentrated way. Sometimes they don't even want it from the black musician themselves.
The New England Conservatory's Hank Osnetsky stops short of a grand theory about why, out of all the immigrant groups that came to America, it was Jewish immigrant musicians that became the main synthesizers of black music.
Jewish immigrants were, in fact, trying as hard as they possibly could to become American. Occasionally, they wrote things that reflected their Jewish roots, and they were fairly self-conscious about that. But in fact, when they were trying to sound African-American, I think they made no bones about the fact that they really were going for that culture and trying to operate within that culture as best they could as American songwriters, and that the process is really an American process there.
But Netsky adds,
I would say that they're both deeply emotional musics, that they both are musics that perhaps are about transcending an environment that might have been intolerable, and transcending that through going to a higher place through musical expression.
And yet, there seems to be more to it. When you look back on a century of American popular music, there is something quite profound going on that, simply listened to, without being refracted through the prism of post-civil rights consciousness, reveals a unique exchange of sensibility. Perhaps the only way to know the truth of what happened is to time travel to a tenement block somewhere in Harlem on a warm day in 1910. sit on the stoop surrounded by the sounds of the street. Not just the sound of a piano or a horn coming out of an apartment played by someone aspiring to be middle class, but the different rhythms and cadences of the language in the street. The questioning chrext of Yiddish, drawling, grammatically colorful, southern-inflected English. Watch how blacks and Jews talk to each other, how their kids play, how they fight. Eavesdrop on the word games played by kids reinventing our most flexible of languages. Listen.
Sand Dune, written by one of your great composers, Berlin.
Jews and Blues Inside Out was written and reported by Michael Goldfarb. The producer and technical director was George Hicks. The program was edited by Anna Benstead. Special assistance was received from the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University and from Hank Osnetsky at the New England Conservatory of Music. For more about the music in this program, photos of the artists, and an essay about the reporting of Jews and Blues Inside Out, please visit WBUR.org and WRNI.org. The executive producer for Inside Out documentaries is Anna Benstead.
That was the documentary Jews and Blues Inside Out from Michael Goldfarb of WBUR Public Radio in Boston, produced in 2001. I hope you enjoyed it. This has been Mini Culture Presents. I'm your curator, Michael Whetstone, and you are undoubtedly tuned in to Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI, Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, supported by generous listener members just like you. Thank you for joining us today for your continued support of KFEI. We hope that you have a happy Hanukkah and stay tuned for the Upside Down.